Hello and welcome to the Paradox Podcast with music. Yes, we have added music to the beginning and the end of this podcast as per your request because we give the people what they want. And today's podcast is entitled Delay, and it's on the concept and idea and day of Holy Saturday. Before we jump into the teaching, I just really quickly want to say, if you are a podcast listener and you're trying to figure out when you should visit Southern California, I would like to personally invite you to join us at Paradox over Easter weekend. Because this past weekend, starting on Thursday, we did Easter in four movements. And I've got to tell you, my heart is full with what people gave and what they did over the past 4 days here at Paradox. Just so you know, on the first movement was on Thursday. It was our first movement called Dine, where we had Last Supper feasts in people's homes, and they shared communion and they shared a Passover meal with their close friends and family. And then on Friday night, we did Doubt Night, where, oh man, people came forward because we did an altar call of doubt. And during this altar call of doubt, people could bring their doubts about God, about Scripture forward, and they shared their laments against God. And we read every one of them in front of the church. Then on Saturday, we commemorated Holy Saturday, which is the one day that Jesus was in the tomb between Friday and Sunday. And we did that with a sermon called Delay, which is this podcast. And then on Sunday was a glorious day because we celebrated deliverance through the resurrection. And we went up to the Appleton Ranch, we climbed up a mountain, and we had a great time singing songs and proclaiming and shouting at the top of our lungs that Jesus Christ was risen. Then we came down the mountain and had pancakes together, and it was just this delicious meal. And all I could say is you have to be there to experience it. So if you're ever considering a trip to Southern California to visit us at Paradox in person, please, please consider Easter weekend in 2019, because we would love to have you. And it's just a thing that our community puts together that I'm just really proud of. And it is a joy to participate in all of the four different movements. So with that in mind, I'd like to turn our attention to Friday night, where Jesus is crucified as the sun is going down. He dies and he's buried in a tomb. And while most people speed ahead to the resurrection on Sunday, there's this day, this interruption, where Jesus stays in the tomb for an entire day. This is known as Holy Saturday. And when you read through the four Gospels, all four Gospels mention Holy Saturday in their own way, and it's very brief how they mention Holy Saturday. In Matthew chapter 28, Matthew writes, after the Sabbath, and then moves on to Resurrection Sunday. Mark writes about Holy Saturday in chapter 16, verse 1, by saying, when the Sabbath was over, and then Mark moves on to Resurrection Sunday. And then there's Luke, who writes about Holy Saturday this way. He says, on the Sabbath, they rested according to the commandment. And then there's John, who doesn't talk about Saturday or Sabbath explicitly, but instead writes about Friday in John 19 by saying, and so because it was the Jewish day of preparation, which is Friday, and the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. You then turn the page and go to the next chapter of John, and John 20 verse 1 says, early on the first day of the week. Sabbath is skipped over in John's gospel. So we have this day that sits between the crucifixion and the resurrection, and most Christians skip over it. After all, Scripture doesn't say much about this day, so should we really spend time talking about it? I believe that we should, but in order to understand why we should talk about Holy Saturday, we need to talk about resurrection first. Now, resurrection is often viewed as this victorious penultimate moment within Christianity. If you don't believe me, go to your web browser and in Google type Resurrection Sunday painting. And what you'll find is all sorts of beams of light as Jesus is floating a few feet off the ground and casting Roman soldiers off to the side. And you'll find all sorts of paintings about how Jesus has conquered the grave. And there are some paintings where Jesus looks sassy toward death, and other paintings where Jesus looks like he's saying, peace out, death, I'm done with you. Christians love resurrection. We love resurrection so much that anytime somebody brings up a question as to whether or not it really happened, that person who brings up the question is often viciously attacked by Christians. Because Christians say without resurrection, there is no Christianity. There's no point to this whole thing. And if you ask most Christians, why is the resurrection important? So often they will spit forth a number of answers about why this is the most important event in human history. But what happens next is interesting, because people who do not identify as Christian then sit down and ask them this question. That's great, but how do you know? How do you know the resurrection occurred? Because, the skeptic might add, you don't really know, do you? Now, I have heard all sorts of Christian apologetics about why we know this resurrection, this bodily resurrection occurred. But the truth is, none of us actually know, do we? And if you can get Christians to be really honest with you, then they will say, yes, I don't know for sure, but I believe it. And when the question is asked, how do you know the resurrection occurred? Eventually a Christian will come back to one word, and this one word will be the way that Christians know that Jesus rose from the dead. That word is faith. Faith. Christians will say at some point, you have to have faith that the resurrection occurred, and that is what is important to God. Now, faith is an interesting word. Because faith is one of those words where most people think they know what it means, but when you ask anyone to define what faith is, people get real uneasy or hesitant. In fact, I can tell you as a spiritual leader that the word faith means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But if you consider yourself a person of faith, I think it's very important that you define what faith means to you. In fact, I would tell you that if you are a person of faith and you don't know how to define the word faith, you should stop using it until you define it. And if you aren't sure where to begin when you're trying to figure out how to define the word faith, a good place to begin is, of course, the dictionary. So if you were to go to the New Oxford American Dictionary, you would find that there are two definitions under the word faith. The first definition is this: complete trust or confidence in someone or something. While that is a good definition of faith, most religious people would look at this definition of faith and feel like it was lacking something. Which brings us to the second definition in this New Oxford American Dictionary. The second definition reads this: faith is strong belief in God or in the doctrines of a religion based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof. In other words, the dictionary tells us that faith is the ability to believe things based on spiritual instinct rather than evidence. Is that what faith is? Most Christians I know would point at that definition of faith and say, yes, faith is the ability to believe things based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof. So that's great. Let's start there and see how this definition works when the rubber meets the road. To talk about this definition of faith, I'd like for us to turn to the 17th century Archbishop of Armagh in Ireland, a man named James Ussher. In 1650, this man published a monumental literary work known as Annales Veritas Testamenti, which in English means Annals of the Old Testament. Now, here's what's really interesting. Some scientists were able to take Annales Veritas Testamenti by James Ussher and turn it into musical form. They actually ran the manuscript through a record player, and this is what Ussher's work sounds like. Isn't science amazing? Anyways, James Ussher, in all seriousness now, James Ussher wrote this book, Annales Veritas Testamenti, and in it, he went through the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible, and he was able to add up all the dates, and he said, I know how old the earth is as attested to by Scripture. When I add up all of the dates in Scripture, and I look at where we are now in 1650, I have determined that the earth began in 4004 BCE. So James Ussher in 1650 said, I know how old the earth is because I've read the Bible. 300 years later, in a place called Pasadena, California, a man named Claire Cameron Patterson said, "I want to figure out how old the Earth is, not by reading the Bible, but through science." And so Patterson, at his school that he taught at, a place called Caltech, which is like a poor man's Montana State University, headed up an experiment in which he studied lead isotopic data from the Canyon Diablo meteorite in 1956. He took the meteorite and was able to measure things that I can barely understand as a pastor. And as he was studying this, Christians everywhere said, "Look, we don't have anything to worry about Patterson's research because we already know how old the Earth is." The Earth, Christians said, is just shy of 6,000 years old. So Patterson studied and he studied and he studied, and he came back with an answer for how old the Earth was. And it was not 4,004 BCE. It was 4.5 billion BCE, give or take 70 million years, which is an amazing margin of error to have, right? But you can imagine that Christians in 1956 believed that their Earth was about 6,000 years old, and then all of a sudden science starts saying, "Well, actually, it's 4.5 billion years old," and they all say, "Whoa, whoa, 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 that's impossible. Science clearly doesn't know what it's talking about because we already know how old the Earth is thanks to James Usher." And so all of a sudden it felt like science was opposing religion. And religious people looked at their own fold and they said, "Look, guys, we need you to be people of faith. If you want to be a person of faith, you believe that the Earth is 6,000 years old, not because you have scientific proof, but because we trust the Bible, and you will be a person of faith if you believe the Earth is 6,000 years old." Is that what faith is? Well, according to our definition, it is. If one believes the age of the Earth to be 6,000 years old rather than 4.5 billion years old because of spiritual apprehension rather than proof, then they are, by the dictionary's definition, being a person of faith. But the thing is, so much has changed since 1956. To give you an idea of how much has changed since 1956, the year after Patterson published his findings on the age of the Earth, the year after, 1957, was when the first man-made object, the Sputnik, made it into space. And since we launched that first object into space, our whole understanding of the stars and our place in the cosmos has changed dramatically. Because we now have telescopes and the ability to fly into space and see the stars in ways we never thought possible. To give you an idea how much has changed and how much we've been able to observe since 1956, let's look at the closest star to our planet. The closest star is, of course, the Sun. Now, the Sun is about 93 million miles away, which I don't know if you know this, but that's a long ways away. To give you an idea of how far it is, you have to consider light and how fast light travels. Light travels at a rate of 186,000 miles per second. So the Sun, which is 93 million miles away, casts light out at 186,000 miles per second. That light travels through the cold vastness of space and eventually arrives on our planet, still hot, which blows my mind. And when it arrives at our planet, it takes about 8 minutes of time for the light to travel from the Sun to our planet. In other words, the Sun is 8 light minutes away. To give you an idea of how exciting this is, when you look up at the Sun, well, you shouldn't look at the Sun. You should always use protection for looking at the Sun. But understand that when you go outside and you see light from the Sun all around you, all of that light left the Sun's surface 8 minutes ago. So if the Sun were to all of a sudden go out or extinguish, we wouldn't know about it here on Earth for 8 minutes. We would still feel the light that the Sun had been pumping out for the 8 minutes before it extinguished. Now let's move our focus from the closest star to our planet to the second closest star. The second closest star is a star named Alpha Centauri, and it is 4 light years away. So when you look up at the night sky and you locate Alpha Centauri, you are looking at light that left Alpha Centauri's surface 4 years ago. And that light has traveled through the cold vastness of space for 4 years before it arrived on our planet's surface so that your photoreceptors in your eye could take that light in. 4 years. So when you look up at the night sky and see Alpha Centauri tonight, you are not seeing Alpha Centauri as it is in 2018. You are seeing Alpha Centauri as it was in 2014. I love this stuff so much because I've often heard human beings say, wouldn't it be great if we could time travel? We can. All it takes is your willingness for you to look up at the night sky and see the stars as they were years ago. So to illustrate this once more, if Alpha Centauri were to extinguish tomorrow, we wouldn't know about it here on Earth until 2022, because all of the light we are seeing is 4 years old. Now, for anyone who believes, through faith, not proof, that the Earth is 6,000 years old, then a star that is of particular note that you can see in the night sky is a star known as the Crab Nebula, and it's about 6,523 light years away. So if you believe that the Earth and the universe is 6,000 years old, then when you look up at the Crab Nebula, you believe then that you are looking at light from the very first days of creation. And you look up at that light and you say, wow, that is as the star looked the moment that God created the Crab Nebula. Now, if it's true that the universe is 6,000 years old, then we should be able to look at the Crab Nebula and the 6,000 light years in between us and the Crab Nebula and say, where the Crab Nebula is the furthest reaches of the universe. We can't go beyond them because there is no creation beyond 6,000 light years. And you should be able to take a star like the Crab Nebula, it's 6,000 light years away, and draw a circle from that point and draw with a radius of 6,000 light years around the Earth, and you would get all of the known universe. In other words, the known universe should not be more than 12,000 light years in diameter if you believe that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. The problem is, if you compare how big 12,000 light years in diameter is to the Milky Way, you realize that the universe is much larger than 12,000 light years in diameter. Because the Milky Way, which is our home of a galaxy, is 120,000 light years in diameter. It is 10 times bigger than the universe should be if the universe was only 6,000 years old. The Milky Way is so large that we are a mere mote of dust within its swirling expanse. And when you look at the Milky Way, you say, whoa, it's 120,000 light years in diameter. That is so much bigger than we could ever imagine. Understand that the Milky Way is one of 2 trillion known galaxies in the universe. 2 trillion is a whole lot. And the universe has to be an amazingly large space in order to contain 2 trillion galaxies within itself. And scientists tell us that the universe is not 12,000 light years in diameter, but instead that the universe is 46 billion light years in diameter. Not only that, but if you go outside tonight and you ask yourself the question, what is the furthest thing I can see with the naked eye? Scientists would tell you that the furthest thing you can see is the Andromeda Galaxy, our nearest galaxy outside of the Milky Way. And when you look up at the heavens and find the Andromeda Galaxy, you are looking at a galaxy that is 2.5 million light years away. And the light that is landing on your tiny little photoreceptors in your eyeballs is light that is 2.5 million years old, that has traveled across just an enormous amount of real estate in order to arrive on your eyeballs. And you and I can see this just by looking up at the sky. But if you have a telescope, and not just any telescope, but the most powerful telescope in the human history, the Hubble, scientists in March of 2016 found an amazing discovery. They found this red splotch, which they affectionately titled GNZ11, and they determined that it was a galaxy 13.4 billion light years away. And the Hubble telescope took a picture of GNZ11, which is 13.4 billion light years away, and this light traveled all the way across the universe. 13.4 billion years ago it left, and it traveled for 13.4 billion years until it landed on the photoreceptor of the Hubble telescope. And when we see this picture, it is a picture of light that is over 13 billion years old. It is from the very beginning of time. Now, when you see a galaxy that is 13.4 billion light years away, it threatens, heavily threatens, in fact, I would say it kills the notion that the universe is 6,000 years old, let alone the idea that the stars were created after the Earth, for which there is zero scientific evidence whatsoever that that occurred. Now, at this point, Christians have a real dilemma. And this dilemma was portrayed in a work of art not too long ago, and it is the best work of art I have seen about this dilemma that Christians face when they face a reality that challenges their faith. The work of art I'm speaking about is the play, The Book of Mormon, which is not a good play to take your parents to. What I found about The Book of Mormon is that you will have a great time if you don't invite your parents and your parents don't take you. Like, that's how you're going to enjoy The Book of Mormon. But The Book of Mormon is about Mormons who go out into the world and they're all of a sudden confronted with a reality that challenges their faith. And one of the Mormons faces a real dilemma because everything he's been told about the way the world works within his missionary training just simply isn't true when he takes his faith out into the world. So this man, a man named Elder Price, has a real choice to make, and he can make one of three choices. The first is to leave the faith and religion completely. The second choice is to change and adapt what he believes to mirror his reality. And the third choice is double down on what he believes and insist that what he believes is true, even though there's a reality that says it is not true. And in the play, Elder Price decides to double down on his faith and say, no matter what happens, I believe in what I was told because, dang it, I'm a Mormon, he says. And a Mormon just believes. I mean, it's way better than when I could sing it, right? But he says, I am a Mormon, and dang it, a Mormon just believes. And so when Christians come across this star, this galaxy that is 13.4 billion light years away, what I found is that Christians are threatened by this. We don't rejoice that a new creation has been discovered. We don't rejoice in God's handiwork as told among the stars. Instead, Christians are threatened by a star like GNZ11, and they freak out. And the most common response is that of Elder Price. They double down and they say, I am a Christian, and dang it, a Christian just believes. I mean, that's what they're doing, right? And Christians respond to the fact that the universe is 46 billion light years in diameter and not 12,000 light years in diameter by saying this: well, God clearly made a 6,000-year-old Earth as attested to in Scripture. And so God made the stars old and put all of that light in place on the fourth day of creation. And the reason that Christians do this is because their definition of faith is that they trust spiritual apprehension more than scientific evidence or proof. Now, this becomes a bigger problem when you consider all of Scripture, because the psalmist in Psalm 19 writes this: the heavens declare the glory of God. The sky displays God's handiwork. Now, this is a problem because if the stars are testifying to who God is, and God creates a reality that is purposely deceitful, then do the stars actually testify to God's handiwork? And what kind of God would try to trick humanity about the age of the earth and then separate the righteous from the wicked based on what they believe rather than what they see about the age of the earth? GNZ11 and its light that is 13.4 billion years old raises some interesting questions, doesn't it? In fact, I would say this idea, this definition of faith, that faith is strong belief in God or in the doctrines of a religion based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof, needs to change. It must change. Because the fact is, it doesn't work. And if that's what great faith is, The ability to believe in a 6,000-year-old universe, even though everything we see in the stars tells us something differently, doesn't sound like a faith that any one of us wants to have. It sounds oppressive rather than inspiring. In fact, when you consider your definition of faith, I would like for you to always remember this idea of the flat Earth. Now, for some strange reason, the idea that the Earth is flat is making a comeback, which is really strange to me, because we have an overwhelming amount of scientific evidence that shows that the world is actually round. I mean, I don't even know where to cite this, because we've known this for about 2,500 years within human history, when Greek philosophers were able to scientifically prove that the Earth was round. And yet, just because people feel like the Earth is flat, they all of a sudden can believe that the Earth is flat. It's a strange, strange time to be alive, isn't it? Now, this strangeness was voiced by Elon Musk. Elon Musk is the founder of SpaceX. He really likes space more than I ever could. When he randomly tweeted one day in November of 2017, he asked the question, why is there no flat Mars society? Why is it that the flat earthers aren't saying that Mars is also flat? And the Flat Earth Society heard about Elon Musk's tweet and they responded by saying, hi, Elon, thanks for the question. Unlike the Earth, Mars has been observed to be round, which I want to give the facepalm emoji 1,000 times. I can't do this. The Flat Earth Society then put the cherry on top of this tweet by saying to Elon Musk, we hope you have a fantastic day. No, Flat Earth Society, you have just ruined my day. The Earth has been observed to be round by astronauts. I can't. I hope that you're laughing as you're listening to this, because it's just ridiculous. And yet, when we look at the people who believe in a flat Earth, despite the overwhelming amount of scientific evidence, by this definition of faith, spiritual apprehension rather than proof, are the people that believe in a flat Earth people of great faith? Is unwavering belief in a flat Earth what great faith looks like? Well, I'd like to answer this question very honestly. The answer is no. No. Faith is not the ability to believe ridiculous things. Faith is not us looking at science and saying, no, I just don't feel it. In fact, I asked at the beginning of this podcast for you to define the word faith. And as you are defining the word faith, I have to tell you that I have this corollary, and it's called the definition of faith flat earth corollary truth, or as I call it for short, the defect. Anytime a definition of faith categorizes flat earthers as people of great faith, then that definition of faith needs to change. In other words, when you define faith for you, and you come up with a definition, run the Flat Earth Society through that definition of faith. And if they come out as people of great faith, then I will tell you have a bad definition of faith, and it's time to get a new one. So even though it's in the dictionary, I'm gonna disagree with the New Oxford American Dictionary. The idea that faith is strong belief in God or in the doctrines of religion based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof, I'm going to say that's a bad definition. We can do better than this. Because when you talk about people of great faith, it's not people who just believed in ridiculous things when overwhelming amounts of science said something different. And it's because of this bad definition of faith that Christians are afraid of the stars rather than celebrating the stars. It's because of this definition of faith that Christians view scientists with suspicion rather than celebration. And so let's change this definition of faith, because we're still talking about Holy Saturday. I didn't forget about it, right? And we're going to talk about what Holy Saturday has to say about faith, but first we need to talk about the person who Holy Saturday commemorates. That person was alive and well, and his name was Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ talked about faith a lot. And in particular, he told a parable, a story about faith in Matthew chapter 25. And the story goes like this. There once was a man who had three servants. And to each of these servants, he gave three gifts. To the first servant, he gave 5 talents. And to the second servant, he gave 2 talents. And to the third servant, he gave 1 talent. He then said, I'm going to go away for a while, and I want you to do something with these talents. So the man left town. The first servant invested the master's gift, and he was able to take his 5 talents and turn it into 10 talents. The second servant also invested his talents, and he was able to turn 2 talents into 4 talents. But the third servant decided to do something different with his talent. He went and bought a shovel. He dug a hole and buried his talent. After some time, the master returned. He went to the first servant and he said, what have you done with the 5 talents I gave you? The first servant said, well, I invested your talent and I was able to take 5 talents and turn it into 10. The master responded by saying these words, well done, enter into the joy of your master, which is a strange thing for a master to say. The master then went to the second servant and said, what have you done with the 2 talents I gave you? The second servant said, I took your 2 talents and I invested it and I've got 4 talents now. To which the master said, well done, enter into the joy of your master, which is a strange thing for a master to say to his servant. The man then went to the third servant and he says, what have you done with my talent that I gave you? The servant responded by saying, master, I knew that you were a harsh man, so I was afraid. And I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what is yours. And the servant took the dirty talent and gave it back to the master. The master replied, you wicked and lazy servant, you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was my own with interest. Take the talent from this servant and give it to the one with 10 talents. For to all those who have more will be given, and they will have an abundance. But from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. As for this worthless servant, throw him into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And the servant was thrown out of the master's household. And there is where Jesus ends the story. Now, if you're like me, there are 3 words in your head right now. This story sucks. What is Jesus trying to say? That God likes it when you get rich? That God makes some people rich and some people poor, and if you're born poor, well, then you've got a harder road in front of you? That happiness can be found in money? And if you're like me, you read this story and you say, Jesus was pretty good at telling parables. This is one where I'm going to have to pass. And this is the way I thought about this story for a long time until a teacher pointed this out to me about what this story is actually about. And I'd like to show what this teacher showed me, because what this teacher showed me changed the entire story completely. The story begins with a master who has 3 servants. He then gives the first servant 5 talents, the second 2 talents, and the third 1 talent. Now, at this point, most American Christians just move on with the story, but it's important for us to ask a question here. How much is a talent worth? Now, everyone who heard this story originally would have known exactly how much a talent was worth. But here we are in Redlands, California in 2018, and we have no idea how much a talent is worth. Well, a talent was worth 6,000 denarii. And 1 denarii is a denarius, and 1 denarius equals 1 day's wage. In other words, a talent is worth about 20 years of work. Now let's put this in today's terms. If you were to figure out how much an American on average makes, it's helpful to eliminate the top 1% from the statistic, because the top 1% makes so much more than the other 99% of Americans. So for the bottom 99% of Americans, the average daily wage is about $175.26. In other words, 1 talent is equal to about $1.05 million. So when Jesus tells the story, his original audience would have heard the master giving the servant 5 talents, and they all would have said, whoa, that's a lot of money. And if we were to tell the story in today's day and age, in 2018, it's much more appropriate for us to say, the master called 3 servants. To the first servant, he gave $5 million. To the second servant, he gave $2 million. And to the third servant, he gave 1 million. The reason this is so important is because we miss the beginning of the story unless we put it in today's context, because this parable begins with extraordinary generosity. Extraordinary generosity. Can you imagine someone saying to their employee, I'm going to leave for a little bit. Here's $5 million. Like, how would you respond to this, right? But it's important to remember that the parable begins with extraordinary generosity. The master then leaves. The first servant turns 5 into 10. The second servant turns 2 into 4. And the third servant turns 1 into 1. The master returns. And the first servant says, I've turned 5 into 10. And he says, well done. Enter into the joy of your master. He then comes to the second servant and he says the same thing to him. Well done, enter into the joy of your master. Then he goes to the third servant, and it's important to know what the third servant said. The third servant said to the master, Master, I knew that you were a harsh man. Really? The master is a harsh man? Because he gave this servant $1 million? The servant goes on to say, so I was afraid. Now understand what's happening here. The master hands the servant $1 million. And the servant responds with what? With fear. The third servant responds to extraordinary generosity with fear. Fear. Now the master said, for to all those who have, more will be given, and they will have an abundance, but from those who have nothing, even what they have will be taken away. Does the third servant have nothing? No. He has $1 million. But even with $1 million in his hand, the third servant feels like he has received nothing. And we so often make the man or the master God in the parables. But what if the man or the master is not God, but is instead reality? And when Jesus tells this story, what he's trying to say is if you view that you have received a lot in this life, if you are the recipient of generosity, then you will find that you have more than enough. But if you respond to the ways the universe has unfolded as scarcity, or you respond with fear, then you will find that you have never enough. Because then the master, or as I believe it, reality, says, as for this worthless servant, throw him into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And the servant has chosen to live there because when he receives extraordinary generosity, he responds with fear. Now let's look at this whole parable, because Jesus begins the story with generosity. From the generosity that is given, it's up to the servants how they will respond. I believe that this response and perception of what the universe has given them is what faith actually is. Because the question at the heart of this story is this: do you believe that the universe is run by generosity or scarcity? And this gets to what faith is. Because if you were to ask me, what does the word faith mean? I would respond by telling you this. Faith is what one trusts about the character of God. Faith is what one trusts about the character of God. And if you trust that this God is loving and generous and merciful, then imagine how that plays out in your life, because it ultimately shapes the way that you interact with every human being you meet. Conversely, if you believe that God is angry, petty, temperamental, vengeful, then you can imagine that if you trust that that's who God is, it will lead you to living a life of scarcity, of fear, of suspicion. Faith is what one trusts about the character of God. And if somebody were to ask me, how can you prove that God is actually loving? I would say to them, I can't. I can trust that God is loving, and I will tell you that makes all the difference in the world. Faith is what one trusts about the character of God. Now, perhaps you're an agnostic or an atheist, and I want to tell you I'm glad that you're listening. And if you're saying to yourself, well, I just can't do the whole God thing, I want you to know I get it. I totally understand. I understand why you can't do the whole God thing. I would say that your definition of faith, though, would be this. Faith is what one trusts about the character of the universe. Because if you don't believe in God, that's fine. That's fine with me. But I would ask you, what do you believe about the universe, or what do you trust about the universe? Is it good to be alive? Is it worthwhile to help others? And if you say yes to both those things, then you are trusting that the universe is a good place to live and that it's worthwhile to do good things. And that, in my opinion, is what it means to be a person of great faith. Faith is what one trusts about the character of God for God believers, or faith is what one trusts about the character of the universe for those who can't do the God thing. Which brings us all the way back to Holy Saturday. When it comes to Easter weekend, Friday and the crucifixion and Sunday and the empty tomb get all the attention, and in the middle of these two monumental days is Holy Saturday. But here's the deal. Saturday is the day between crucifixion and resurrection. Saturday is the day between despair and hope. Saturday is the day between fear and faith. Saturday is between violence and beauty. Saturday is the reality between suffering and grace. And Saturday is the day between scarcity and generosity. And ultimately, Saturday is the day filled with death and life. Which raises the question, is Holy Saturday about the body of Jesus in a tomb? Or is Holy Saturday about human life? Because here's what actually happened. God is dead. God is dead inside of a tomb. And outside of that tomb, there are people who are weeping, crying, mourning, suffering, grieving through this loss of Jesus Christ. And it's here on Holy Saturday that God could do something about their suffering, and God delays. Holy Saturday is the day when God delays. And the reason I find Holy Saturday so inspiring is because Holy Saturday is our reality. Have you ever watched a loved one go through a horrible sickness? And you've prayed to God to do something about this sickness, and at the same time, you hold this belief that God can do something about the sickness, but God delays. We live in the delay. We live in this moment and this reality with broken hearts and shattered dreams, where God simply doesn't do something to fix our suffering. We live in the delay of Holy Saturday. Now, Christians, when we talk about faith, we often point at Resurrection Sunday and say, ah, see, you must have faith in that so that you can get to the next life and then you can begin to live the life that matters. When I look at the teachings of Jesus, particularly the parable of the three servants, I want to tell you that I found something quite different to be true. Faith answers the question, how do we live here? What can we trust about God in the delay? Because between life and death is the world and the reality that we live through day in and day out. And so it is in the midst of this reality, not the next one, but this reality, that we have to ask the question, what do we trust about the character of God? And the thing that Jesus does throughout his life while he is walking around and speaking and eating with others is he tries to insist to people that how you treat and interact with others and this earth and with God really matters. It's worthwhile. It is an endeavor that is worth taking and paying attention to. And so between life and death on Holy Saturday and the delay of God, Jesus asks us the question, what do you trust about the character of God? Because that will shape everything in the way that you live on Holy Saturday. Our faith is what we trust about the character of God. I'd like to close by telling you about a song by the songwriter Ryan O'Neill, who uses the moniker Sleeping at Last when he's writing his songs. He wanted to write a song about life and death and how we humans respond to death in this life. So he wrote a song called Saturn. And when he was asked about what led to him writing the song Saturn, he said, Saturn is a song about losing someone close and deeply loved, but it's about the good they left behind in our lives and how to reflect that in your relationships in front of you. And so to tell the story of how, after someone dies, they still have a positive impact on our life right here, right now, in the delay of Holy Saturday. Ryan uses the metaphor of the stars, and he writes my favorite lyric I have ever heard in any song. The lyric goes like this from the song Saturn. He writes, "You taught me the courage of stars before you left, how light carries on endlessly even after death." That is amazing songwriting. You taught me the courage of stars before you left, how light carries on endlessly even after death. What he's referencing is the fact that when stars die, their light continues to shine throughout the universe even after they are dead. He then goes on to write, "With shortness of breath, you explain the infinite, how rare and beautiful it truly is that we exist." What Ryan is writing about is what he trusts to be true about the character of the universe. And even in the midst of death and life, there is a goodness to this reality that is worth trusting. And so, my brothers and sisters, as you consider Holy Saturday, may I ask you to define what faith means to you. And when you look at the larger scope of things and you consider your life in the delay of God, I can tell you that for me, I have found an enormous amount of wealth in the ability to trust in the goodness, forgiveness, redemption, reconciliation, hope, generosity, kindness, compassion, and love of God. May you see and embrace Jesus Christ.